Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. My name is George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We welcome our audiences here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and on the radio and online. And tonight it's my pleasure to introduce the speaker, Guy Gugliotta, who has written on Freedom's Cap. Just one short piece of background. At the time that this idea was brought to me, I had just finished reading, not every single bit of it, but a big portion of the history of the Civil War as seen in the New York Times at the time, which was all the excerpts from the New York Times. And so I thought it would be fascinating to bring the idea of what it was like during this very, very unusual time of tension in America's history, the decade leading up to the Civil War. And while that was going on, the building of the Capitol, which I had not thought of. So it was a great combination. Guy.
Thanks very much, George. Freedom's Cap, Freedom's Cap is the story of how the United States Capitol grew from a very small, sort of provincial, state-like state house into the magnificent building that we know today. This occurred between 1850 and 1865, a time in which the provides us with a considerable irony, because here you have what would become the most important symbol of Republican democracy in the world going up. At the same time, that same Republican democracy was going down the tubes. And so what we're talking about is getting from here. Whoops. This is the U.S. Capitol in 1850. It is today the center section of the Capitol with a new dome. And we're talking about moving from that to this. Capitol today, during between 1850 and 1865, the two wings, Senate on the right as you sit and look, House on the left, and the cast iron dome were added. And the entire building was refaced. The Freedom's Cap is secondarily about the story of three separate individuals who had a role in building it. Thomas E. Walter, the architect who designed it, Montgomery C. Meigs, the engineer who built it, and, oddly enough, Jefferson Davis, Secretary of War, Senator from Mississippi, who, right up until the moment he left Washington to become President of the Confederacy, was the biggest advocate of changing the small structure into the large structure that you see today. I'm going to start by reading a passage, a short passage from the book, which will sort of put you, I hope, in the moment, in the crucial moment, in the building of the Capitol. This takes place in early 1856, which I consider to be sort of the moment when the idea of building a new Capitol became popular, and just at the same time as the idea that there would be no solution to the slavery dispute became clear to many people. 1856 was the year when Preston Brooks, a congressman from South Carolina, practically beat the abolitionist Charles Sumner to death on the floor of the Senate. 1856 was the year when a band of thugs led by John Brown hacked five pro-slavery settlers to death in Kansas. 1856 was Bleeding Kansas. And at that time, it suddenly became clear to a great many people that there would be no resolution to this. And at the same time, it also became clear to many people that the United States Capitol, the sort of grody building growing into a swan, was very important to the nation and became sort of a symbol of what could be or what might be. Army Captain Montgomery C. Meigs was not a timid man. Bearded and burly, he stood over 6 feet tall and weighed close to 200 pounds. Downturned lips and a pair of dark, glittering eyes gave his broad face an intimidating, challenging cast. None of this was an illusion. Meigs, at 39, was just beginning to realize his potential, which was considerable. He was intelligent, ambitious, capable, imposing, and arrogant. He had graduated fifth in his class at West Point in 1836 and would have done better, he wrote later. But the commandant marked him down 100 points because, quote, I had many demerits. His mother had once described Meigs as, quote, high-tempered, unyielding, tyrannical toward his brothers, very persevering in pursuit of anything he wishes. That was when he was six. Not much had changed. When he arrived at his office in the U.S. Capitol building on January 11, 1856, he had an awkward task to perform. Meigs was an engineer by profession, and on this Friday had served for nearly 3 years as superintendent in charge of transforming the cramped, crowded, hard-used U.S. Capitol building into a magisterial seat of government, with new marble wings for the Senate and House of Representatives and a spectacular central dome made of cast iron. Late the previous fall, just before the snow started, his men had finished tearing down the Capitol's old wooden dome, a rotting, leaking, copper-sheathed fire hazard, and had covered the hole with a temporary roof, a wooden frame draped in waterproof canvas. It kept the rotunda dry, and already the lawmakers, lobbyists, and hangers-on who thronged the building during the day had pretty much forgotten it was there. He had done all this quickly, and he thought, elegantly. What he had done next, however, had never been tried before, as far as he knew, at least not on any kind of big building. From a base on the floor of the Capitol Rotunda, he had erected a wooden tower made of four large timbers strapped together. It stretched upward through the center of the new roof and beyond. On top of the tower, the highest point in the city of Washington, he had mounted a derrick and a boom that was able to swing 360 degrees. When a multi-ton piece of cast iron was ready for installation, teamsters would put it in a wagon and bring it to the base of the building, where it would be winched to the top of the new Senate wing. Then the new boom would drop a hook, grab the piece, lift it all the way up to the dome, and swing it around so the iron workers could easily bolt it into place. There would be no manhandling and virtually no need for scaffolding. The construction team would use a ladder to climb the tower and work from a catwalk below the boom. It was not even that complicated. Meigs, utterly certain of his technical brilliance, embraced his engineering challenges with joy. But in many ways, building the Capitol was a thankless job. Meigs had already spent significant time and talent dodging contractors' kickbacks, refusing employment to party hacks and thieves, lobbying Congress for extra money, and fending off political dust-ups. This year was shaping up to be even nastier. At least 100 of the 234 House members in the incoming Congress were know-nothings, anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant nativists who kept their affiliation secret from outsiders. They were going after Meigs for hiring foreigners, many of them Catholic, to paint the Capitol's murals, carve its stone, and design its ornaments. Meigs was a Democrat, and immigrants were an important Democratic constituency. But politics, if you were to ask him, had nothing to do with his hiring practices. Skilled stonemasons, artisans, and artists, many of them undesirables or fugitives from failed revolutions in France, Germany, and Italy, were washing up at U.S. ports by the shipload. Meigs wanted the best. The job deserved the best. And he did not care where the best came from, what language they spoke, or what god they worshipped. Immigration was a spigot that belched experts. He would have been a fool not to hire them. He had learned to ignore the political carping. Much harder to deal with was the tension over slavery. There was nothing Meigs could do about it, but the growing rancor was crippling the government. The wheels were turning ever more slowly, and Meigs, who needed new money every year to continue building the Capitol, had to have a Congress that was willing to act on his legislation. But right now, it was impossible to get Congress to act on anything. President Franklin Pierce, a Democrat, had submitted his annual message to Congress, but the new House had refused to let it be formally read or debated until a speaker was elected. And the failure to do so for 100 ballots and counting was because different factions distrusted the aspirants' positions on slavery. Pierce's message talked a lot about foreign affairs, but most of what he said was shadowed by the slavery question. There was a dispute with Great Britain over possible Isthmian canal routes across Central America, where Southerners were hoping to create a new slave state. The previous year, U.S. diplomats had called on Spain to sell Cuba to the United States and threatened to take Cuba by force if Spain refused. The idea, once again, was to make Cuba a slave state. Closer to home, in the western reaches of the Louisiana Purchase, rival gangs of pro-slavery and abolitionist thugs had been dueling for almost 2 years over the future, slave or free, of what would come to be called Bleeding Kansas. There was no resolution in sight, and with a speakerless House, the government had all but ground to a halt. Meigs had his own views about slavery. Although he had been born in Augusta, Georgia, his mother had forced his father to move back to Philadelphia because she could not stand the idea of raising her family in a slave state. On the other hand, Meigs was a good Democrat, and Democrats, especially Southern Democrats, were slavery's biggest supporters. Ultimately, however, Meigs did not have to have an opinion about slavery. As an Army officer, he was never asked for one, and he never offered one. More important, keeping quiet was critical for Meigs because his boss was Secretary of War Jefferson Davis of Mississippi. Everybody knew Davis as a formidable public figure, one of the most outspoken slavery and states' rights advocates in Washington. What everybody had not known, at least at first, was that he was also the political guiding spirit of the Capitol Project, a role he had assumed as a senator when it was launched in 1850 and had eagerly resumed as a member of Pierce's cabinet. Davis had hired Meigs in 1853 and had supported him unfailingly in making elaborate changes to the new Capitol's design, in planning the sumptuous decor that Meigs wanted for the new wings, and in substituting more durable and more expensive materials everywhere in construction. Meigs wanted the Capitol to last. So did Davis. Davis was not only Meigs' mentor, but also, as Meigs said in his diary, quote, my superior and my friend. When Meigs finalized his plan for building the dome with a boom derrick, he had described the apparatus in numbing detail in a long letter to Davis, probably because he knew that Davis, who, like Meigs, loved gadgets and innovation, would read every word. The previous day, Meigs and his family had eaten supper at the Davis home. Anyone who opposed Davis took a risk. He was an eloquent, even an inspiring advocate. In private, he was an intimidating infighter, a feuder and grudge holder capable of towering rages. He was a loyal ally, but a vicious enemy. Meigs, who had never experienced the bad Davis, knew he could not have had a finer protector, but he also knew he had to keep the faith. Once a person got on Davis's bad side, he seldom got off. Worrying about Davis is what had brought Meigs to the task that currently lay before him. 2 months earlier, he had received a letter and a photograph from Thomas Crawford, an American sculptor based in Rome. The photograph depicted the statue of a woman. Crawford called her Freedom Triumphant in War and Peace. And she was absolutely exquisite, an elegantly draped, quote, light and beautiful figure, Meigs wrote in his diary. She was to be placed atop the new dome. Freedom would stand, literally, at the pinnacle of American democracy. Meigs needed to have Davis approve the design. The statue was not the hard part. Davis, like Meigs, was a cultured man. How could he not like the statue? The problem, Meigs knew, was the narrow, floppy cloth hat that Freedom wore. It was a liberty cap, the symbol from classical antiquity of a manumitted slave, which had been revived during the American and French revolutions. Davis did not like liberty caps. He had made that clear some time ago. Liberty caps had little meaning in the United States, Davis had told Meigs. Quote, he says it is a sign of a freed man, Meigs wrote in his diary, quote, and that we were always free, not freedmen, not slaves, just released. If Meigs agreed with this bit of oblique sophistry, he left no record of it. Nor did he comment on or apparently even think about what could become a much larger and potentially far more incendiary problem, the irony of using a freed slave as a symbol of liberty in a nation that was holding 4 million people in bondage. Meigs was smitten with a statue, as he wrote in his diary, but pessimistic about its future. Freedom, he noted in his diary, had, quote, the inevitable liberty cap to which Mr. Davis will, I do not doubt, object. Now he was sending Davis the photograph. He had tactfully made his own position clear in an accompanying note without mentioning the liberty cap. The statue's, quote, strongly marked lines and shadows, he had said, quote, will, I think, give it a striking effect, even at the height of 300 feet at which it is to stand. He handed the envelope to a messenger. So, please feel free to jump in with questions whenever you like. I'd like, I think, now to talk a little bit about, to give you a look at exactly what we're talking about. Yes. There we are. In fact, there were three statues of freedom. The one on the left, as you see it here, was the original. An olive branch in the left hand, sword and shield of the United States in the right hand, laurel wreath in the hair. Both Meigs and Davis loved this one. The problem, and Meigs wrote to Crawford, was that there was no pedestal, and Crawford envisioned that this freedom would stand directly on top of the dome. Meigs wanted it to be lifted up. And so he wrote Crawford a letter saying, we both really love this, but please give her a pedestal. Well, Crawford came back with the one on the right, which is the one that we just read about. Big pedestal, but completely different statue. And a liberty cap, which, as Meigs predicted, Davis would not like. And he didn't like it. So Meigs sent it back. And this is what Crawford came up with. This is Freedom Triumphant in War and Peace, the third copy, and this is what sits atop your Capitol today. She's heftier than the other two, as you can see, and quite unusual looking. The curator at the Architects of the Capitol, at the Architect of the Capitol's office, insisted to me that Crawford decided to depict a Minerva figure, and that was the aim here, and which is okay, Minerva. But both Davis and Crawford himself thought that they were using a Native American princess as sort of their motif. You can see the sort of buckskin-like skirt here, but at the waist it kind of gives way to this classical drapery. And then you have the extraordinary headdress, which was supposed to be eagle feathers, but in fact, at least to me, looks like a rooster with its mouth open. She's 19 feet tall, and as opposed to the others, which were about 15 feet tall, and weighs 4 or 5 more tons than the other two. So the question comes, why did he do this? And the second question is, why did he change the first design to create the second? And I think there are clues in Meigs' diary about why he decided to do this. Crawford, you need to know, was from the Bronx. And Crawford had never seen an Indian in his life, almost for sure. And he had done a couple other jobs for Meigs, and Meigs had kept writing Crawford letters saying, please, please, go to the Vatican Library, or please, please go to the U.S. Embassy and take a look at these two or three books of illustrations of Indian life that had been recently published. And clearly, Crawford didn't go, and so you have Minerva, you know, the Indian princess with very European features and a rooster on top of her head. So then we go and we say, so, but why did he do this on the right? And here we have no clue. And but I have a theory, which I didn't put in the book, but which I will recount to you. One of Meg's shortcomings, and there were some significant shortcomings, was that he had just dreadful handwriting. And it is, or it was, no, it is, because I had to do it, almost impossible to read his handwriting. And he loved Crawford, and he'd write Crawford 14 and 15-page letters and tell him all about the art that he was putting in the Capitol, tell him all about all the gossip about what was going on in the Capitol and in Washington. And he'd just write these just extensive letters, and he would start off, and you could almost see him sticking his tongue out for the first three lines as he tried to write it legibly. But then patience was not one of Meg's virtues, and so that he began to write faster and faster. And usually by about the third paragraph, you couldn't understand a thing. So I can picture Crawford, his wife, and every expat in Rome sort of sitting around the kitchen table figuring out, he wants a pedestal. He says, but what else? He says, God, I can't figure it out. He says, well, maybe he just wants a new statue. So maybe that's how the new statue arose. But I'm not quite sure. In any case, that's what we got. And it was the... statue was put on and completed in 1863 and mounted in 7 months after the Battle of Gettysburg, at a time when neither side thought the war would ever end. Yes, sir.
The first one on the left it looks like it's a model of something. Was anything ever done with it?
Oh, yes. All three of these were plaster models. And they were all three independently created by Crawford and photographed and then sent one by one, as I described. All three of them are in the Capitol. All three of the models are in the Capitol. This one here is actually in the Capitol Visitor Center, so that if you went into the Capitol Visitor Center in the basement of the Capitol, you could see it. And the other two... I am not sure exactly where they are. I believe that number one, the one on the left, is by the Senate subways and the catacombs leading from the Senate office buildings to the Senate proper. And I believe number two is on the House side in a similar location in one of the tunnels in the lobby of one of the House office buildings. But all three are actually there right now. Yes?
What was the final statue made out of, and how did it get up there?
Ah, great question. It was made of bronze. and oddly enough, it was cast by a sculptor named Clark Mills, who had done what is a famous equestrian statue of Andrew Jackson in Lafayette Park, which is right alongside the White House. And Mills had a foundry in Bladensburg, which is a town right on the edge of the district on the way to Annapolis, just east of Washington proper. And so Mills was from South Carolina, and oddly enough, in 1860, he got the entire South Carolina delegation, the most rabid secessionists in the country, to lobby President Buchanan to get the job, and he got it. So he cast the statue in six pieces, and he had them bolted together and the statue set up in the yard of his... in the yard of his workshop. I mention all this because this is leads to a very interesting point. It is pretty well known that the original Capitol was built almost entirely by slave labor. And as it is impossible to tell whether slaves were used to make the expansion of the Capitol, and if so, how many and in what capacity. Meigs never hired a slave, and most of the people that worked on the Capitol for him were public employees. And but he also hired contractors, and it is impossible to know whether the contractors had slaves. But Clark Mills owned a slave, and the only slave that we know that worked on this project was a man named Philip Reed. And when the statue had been bolted together in six pieces, the decision was made that they were going to transfer it to the yard, to the grounds in front of the dome, and reassemble it so that people could see it before it was actually picked up and put on top of the new dome. So it had to be taken apart, and each piece had to be put in a wagon and brought to the brought from Bladensburg to the Capitol grounds, a distance of maybe perhaps 10 miles. And so Mills, all his foundry men were foreigners because foreigners knew how to do this kind of thing. And they were also radicals of one kind or another, and they went on strike. They weren't going to take the statue apart, and they weren't going to put it in the wagons, and they weren't going to transfer it, and they weren't going to assemble it. They weren't going to do anything until Clark Mills gave them a raise. And but then Philip Reed stepped forward, and he said, "Well, I know how to do this." And so Philip Reed unbolted the statue. They took it apart. And as the story goes, they put the pieces in the wagons, took them to the grounds, where Philip Reed reassembled the statue, where it sat for a couple of years, probably 1861 to 1863, while they finished the dome and prepared it. Then, when the dome was finished, they disassembled the statue again in six pieces, and they used the derrick here to pick up each piece and imagine the dome here. This is a Walter's drawing, but imagine the dome being up there all the way to the top without the statue on top. And so, and the derrick is up there on top instead. And they take, using this boom here, they pluck each piece up, they bring it up, and they put it in place. And just about exactly 12:30 noon, 12:30 in the afternoon on December 3rd, 1863, the workmen hoisted the final piece, the head and the headdress, up, bolted it into place, and Walter, who didn't believe in speeches, had simply announced in the newspaper that this was going to be done, and there were thousands of people on the grounds watching this, and as it was bolted into place, 13 forts around the city of Washington gave off a salute, one gun for each state, including the seceded states, to announce that the dome was completed and that the statue was installed. Yes.
Do you think that Crawford intended to make a political statement by half on the second statue?
I thought about that. I don't think so. He was a very Meigs liked him because he worked fast. He was no sort of a prima donna. And he had made no political statements one way or the other about this. What is peculiar about the whole exchange is Meigs' refusal to actually tell Crawford not to do this. And I think that was just good bureaucratic sense. Because what had happened, Meigs, as I said, was not pro-slavery, but he wanted to keep working on the job. So here you have the Pierce administration, and you have the Secretary of War of the Pierce administration, which at that time had one more year to run, and the Secretary of War doesn't like the Liberty Cap. And so he says he doesn't like the Liberty Cap, but he doesn't say don't put it on or do put it on. But the implication's clear. But Meigs doesn't say that in the letter to Crawford. He says that Mr. Davis says that the Liberty Cap is a sign of a freedman and not, and that we were never freedmen, we were never slaves, blah, 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 as I read. But he doesn't say, so get rid of it. He doesn't say that because he wants his job. And if whoever replaces Pierce in 1857 is not a Southern sympathizer like Pierce, then he's in trouble. And so he's a clever bureaucrat, and so he decided to fudge it. So he left it up to Crawford. So Crawford's sitting there, you know, and that's really unkind to Crawford because it sort of leaves it up to Crawford. So I think that Crawford might have done it not necessarily to make a political statement, but to toss it in Meigs' face and say, okay. And it's if you don't like it, here we go. It's hard to say. There is no evidence that Crawford was in any way a political activist of any kind. So anyway, I will let you take a look at some of the things that were wrong with the old Capitol. This is the old Senate. It is set up as a museum today. It's was an attractive, small room, good for debate. And the debates were fantastic in the Senate. These were the days of Calhoun, Clay, Webster, Thomas Hart Benton, Stephen A. Douglas, Jefferson Davis. And the debates were the most heavily attended tourist event in all of Washington, D.C., and perhaps in the United States. You can see the the balcony against the wall. It's only two tiers, and only a few people could see. The problem with the Senate was that it was very, very cold in the winter, very, very hot in the summer. And senators would sit wrapped in buffalo robes and blankets in the middle of the winter sessions. Sam Houston wore a Mexican poncho and a sombrero during the debates. And senators would walk back and forth in back of the president pro tempore of the Senate, walk back and forth to warm themselves up with their hands on their butts and walking up to these two pot-bellied stoves that were trying to heat the place. And if that didn't work, you could always go outside and to a little place called the Hole in the Wall where out of contingency funds the Senate had built themselves a little bar where you could have pretty much as much whiskey as you wanted. And late night sessions in January could get pretty raucous at times. So anyway, it was there were shortcomings in to the Senate. And and the other thing that I forgot to mention is that although you never find anybody in the United States, no American ever mentions this in the congressional record or in contemporary accounts, everybody in the Senate and the House either chewed plug tobacco or used snuff. There were spittoons all over the all on the floors of the all through the both chambers. And anytime you read an account by a European who visited the United States, this would be almost the first thing they would say. And this was really disgusting. And Charles Dickens said, The Senate is just a lovely room. It's great for debate. But if you drop something, don't. Even if it's your purse, don't ever pick it up without gloves on. And so the Senate needed a makeover. The House was a lot easier sell. This is known today as Statuary Hall, and it was the House of Representatives for about 50 years. And quite simply, it had the worst acoustics of any place that any of these folks had ever been in. And if you were standing to speak in front of the well here, there'd be some guy way back here that could hear everything that you said because he would be standing in some sort of acoustical sweet spot, and he could speak in just a normal speaking voice, and you could hear him. Yeah. But somebody here, two or three rows in, would hear nothing but white noise. And it was utter bedlam. And so bad that several people suggested that one of the reasons that Northerners and Southerners were so at each other's throats was because they had to scream at each other all the time, and all civility had gone awry, and it was because the acoustics were so bad. So when the initial appropriation was put before the House, it was pretty much voted by acclamation. They wanted a new place. So this is what they got. This is the new house, and it's in 1858. The new house was completed, the new chamber was completed in December of 1857, and the house occupied it on December 7th or December 8th of that year. This is February 1858, and I put this up for this slide for two reasons. Because what you have here is you have an epic brawl between Southerners and Northerners over a slavery question. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning on February 8th, and so you can see that having a new chamber where you could hear the debates and everything didn't make any nice. They were still in each other's throats. The second thing to notice about this is that Frank Leslie's Illustrated newspaper uses the United States Capitol in 1858 as its logo. So what had happened was that by this time, it was pretty much clear to everybody that there was going to be no resolution of the slavery question short of some sort of secession or worse. And the Capitol had come to represent what might be or what the United States might become. It was something that legislators of all persuasions, all areas, were voting for pretty much regularly. They were voting the appropriations. There was no problem at all. Because it was something that had nothing to do with slavery, and it was something that pointed toward the greatness of the United States. And their interest in doing this, in voting the money, was rooted as much in despair as it was in triumph, because they knew, many of them suspected, that that the United States could not or perhaps would not survive this dispute, but perhaps it would if it had a seat of government, a majestic seat of government like the new Capitol. Now, the other thing you notice is that you can see all of the new Capitol except the dome, and that's because that by 1858, Walter, the architect, and Meigs, who I read about earlier, were at each other's throats, and they weren't getting along. And what had happened was that Walter, in 1854, had come up with sort of the killer application for the United States Capitol. In 1854, when the project was still not particularly popular, Walter had this tremendous idea. He said, well, I think we ought to take off the old dome and we ought to put a new dome on the building. So he painted this. This was a painting, and it's lost. It was 7.5 feet long. And Walter drew it and tinted it and framed it and put it up alongside the office of the Capitol the Capitol Project offices on the first floor of the House of Representatives in late 1854. And so congressmen and senators could walk past this, and they could look at the dome, you know, and it's big, you know. And the United States, we love big, you know, big is better. And so they liked that. They thought that was spectacular. But also, you see how Lord cleverly draws in, I think you see this, draws in all these very elegant people, nice carriages, people with parasols, walking across in front of the dome. So that the congressmen and senators could not only see what the Capitol could become, but they could put themselves in the picture. And they liked that. And so the building became very popular, started to become very popular at the end of 1854. Meigs was jealous. And he had been trying to make his mark with the elaborate decorations inside and with engineering innovations. But as soon as he saw this, he knew that this was going to define the Capitol for all time, and that Walter had pretty much done what needed to be done, and this was always going to be Walter's building. So we come to 1858, and the Buchanan administration is in, and by this time, Meigs is sure that Walter is trying to get him fired from the project. That now that Buchanan's in and Davis is no longer the Secretary of War, that Walter can influence the Buchanan administration to have Meigs thrown out and have him installed as the engineer in control of the project. Meigs, Walter, for his part, he's convinced that Meigs is trying to take credit for his work by defacing the drawings and by inserting himself in design issues that are none of his business. Well, the interesting thing about this is that both men were absolutely right. This was indeed happening on both sides, and there was no resolution of it. But as you can see, by the end of 1858, construction on the dome had absolutely stopped because Walter wouldn't give Meigs any drawings, and Meigs wouldn't go to Walter's office to look at the drawings. And so Frank Leslie had no idea what the dome was supposed to look like, and so he decided to put a T right there. So... And so there you have it. And so Walter won this battle in 1859. Buchanan fired Meigs, but it was a hollow victory, and Meigs didn't care much by that time because it was apparent that Buchanan was not going to get reelected and that Buchanan was running one of the most corrupt and useless administrations that had ever held power in the United States. And so Meigs was sent to the Dry Tortugas off the coast of Key West to build forts for a while, but he left certain that he would be back and not to worry. And that was correct. He was gone for a year, and then he came back, tried to fire Walter, but that didn't work. And then all of it became sort of irrelevant because all of a sudden they were in the middle of the Civil War. And Meigs became the Quartermaster General of the Union Army, a job that he held for 21 years. And he is an iconic figure in the Army Corps of Engineers and is the man who was responsible for fueling the supply train that Grant took south with him in 1864. He was on the ships waiting for Sherman and Savannah after Sherman marched to the sea. And he was indeed a member of Lincoln's inner circle and one of the most powerful men in Washington. He didn't really have time for the Capitol anymore. And so Walter took it over again in 1862. And it was Walter that put the statue on. It was Walter who completed the project pretty much by the end of 1865. Oddly enough, the two men reconciled many, many years later. There was a plan afoot to expand the Library of Congress, which up until the current Library of Congress building was built, was in fact in the Capitol as well. And the Speaker of the House of Representatives sent a letter to Meigs, who was at the time was still Quartermaster General, saying what did he think about the idea of expanding the Capitol to include a new library. And Meigs wrote the Speaker back, and he said, don't touch it. He said, Thomas Walter created the perfect building here. Don't mess with it. And the Speaker took this and sent this letter to Walter. And Walter saw the letter, and then he wrote to Meigs. And they began to plot together to make a design for the new Library of Congress. Their design didn't fly, but the two men met several times at the twilight of their lives in the 1880s and were fully reconciled. Such was not the case between Meigs and Jefferson Davis. Meigs regarded Davis as a traitor. He became militant pro-unionist, not surprisingly, but militantly anti-Confederate, and especially reserved his deepest hatred for people who, like himself, had gone to West Point and then, in his mind, had betrayed the oath that they had given to the United States. And he, on several occasions, expressed the desire that Davis and General Lee ought to be hanged. And it was Meigs who designed Arlington Cemetery, deliberately designed it to be on Robert E. Lee's plantation in Arlington, and deliberately designed it so that the first plots where his own son and several other early dead were buried, that the first plots would be right in Mrs. Lee's rose garden, so that if she ever thought of coming back, she'd think again. And he was absolutely adamant about this and absolutely stubbornly steadfast. When Jefferson Davis was arrested and thrown into jail in Fortress Monroe in Hampton Roads after the war, his wife wrote Meigs a letter at one point and said, essentially, for old time's sake, can I at least send him letters if I can't send him food? Davis looked at the letter for about 2 or 3 days and then finally decided, nah, I'm not even going to answer, and didn't answer. And Davis, for his part, never, ever returned to Washington, even though he lived deep into the 1880s and died quite old. He never returned to Washington, and he never really expressed much of a desire to know what had happened. However, in Statuary Hall, what was the old House of Representatives, each state is allowed to send two statues to put in the hall. Mississippi sent Jefferson Davis, so he stands in Statuary Hall today. Yes.
Can you talk a little more about the irony of Davis being Secretary of War and President of the Capitol?
Sure. Davis was an interesting person. I think the person that first attracted me to this project, he's almost a split personality. Because when the Capitol Project begins, it's 1850, which is the year of the Great Compromise. And what had happened was that the United States had won this huge tract of land from the Mexicans in 1848. 1849, gold had been struck in California, and by 1850, there were 90,000 U.S. citizens living in California. And California needed to become a state. Well, it was not popular, to say the least, to spend money in Washington, D.C., or to spend money on a federal building. Most congressmen and senators, virtually all, whether they were Southerners, whether they were Northerners, whether they were slaveholders or abolitionists, were pretty much interested in having the federal government buy them a post office, or have the federal government dig the tree stumps out of their riverbank, or have the federal government build them a port city, or build them a breakwater so that they could have ships come in. In other words, it was the 1850s equivalent of the Bridge to Nowhere. You know, it was all about jobs, and it was all about getting the government to spend money on your state or your community or your district, pretty much the way it is today. But what happened was that Davis, as this debate began, nobody was louder, nobody was nastier, nobody was more militant about slavery and states' rights than Jefferson Davis. I think he contributed as much to anybody to escalating the debate and polarizing the country over this during this period. At the same time, he was the leading advocate, and exactly at the same time, for an expansion of the United States Capitol. The obvious argument was, we got all this new property, we got all this new territory, we're going to have many more new states, we're going to have many more senators, we're going to have many more congressmen, we need more space. So that was the first thing. But Davis took it one step further. He said at one point during the debate over the $100,000 that he wanted to start this project, he said that what was important here was that a great nation needed a great seat of government, you know, not a tobacco-stained relic with the timbers rotting and where lawmakers couldn't hear one another speak. And several of his opponents stood up and say, well, we've spent $100,000 here. We'll be spending $100,000 the next year. We'll be spending $1 million. This will cost millions and millions of dollars. And Davis, which of course is true, because if you know anything about Congress, you know that once a program starts, it never stops. So the idea is to get your foot in the door and then keep funding it. But Davis, instead of backing away from that, stood up and he said, yes, you're right. That's true. But I'll tell you this, is that you can give me $100,000, you can give me $1 million, but there's not enough money that you can give me that's going to pay for what we're eventually going to need. Eventually, the United States government is going to have buildings all over this hill. And he was right. And he never had a problem juggling these two things. Like, he's a great proponent of expanding the authority and the majesty of the federal government. At the same time, he is the leading advocate for states' rights, limited federal government, and keep the federal government out of our affairs. He had no problem with these two conflicting ideas until he had a real problem, and then he chose. But I believe that he was able to do this mostly because he had been in the Army, and a lot of Army folks felt the same way, had the same sort of nationalist feeling, because they traveled a lot. They had been to West Point. They had been out in the middle of nowhere in Minnesota, like Davis, building forts, working as cavalry, riding out into the territories in West Texas and in Oklahoma. They'd seen the country, and they knew what it looked like. Because remember, this was a time when there was no TV. I mean, you didn't know what the rest of the country looked like. You just you never heard anything about it, and you never saw anything about it, and it was just sort of an abstraction to you. You knew about your community, you knew about your church, you knew about you knew a little bit about Washington, and but not much. And a big deal for you if you lived in upstate New York was to go to the city and spend the day eating in restaurants, you know, big deal. And that was it. And you never even saw anything else. And but the Army folks did. They knew. Yes?
I'd like to remind our audiences on the radio and online that they're listening to Guy Gugliotta, the author of Freedom's Cap, and we have time for about three or four more questions.
How much did this reconstruction cost from, say, 1850 till they put the statue on top?
I have that number in the book, and I had written it down, and because I knew somebody was going to ask me that, and I don't know the answer, but I think we're talking somewhere around $5 million, and $5 million and $1,850 dollars. And yes.
In San Francisco, there is a Meigs Wharf. Is there any connection with the Meigs in this story?
Probably. His he came from an enormous family, and it was a his father was a famous obstetrician. Actually, I think practically invented the discipline of obstetrics in the United States. Philadelphia obstetrician. Meigs became a major general. His son became a major general, also named Montgomery Meigs. His grandson became a major general, and there's, I think, a major general named Meigs in the Army today. So it wouldn't surprise me at all.
How did the thing hold up over 150 years? Did they require any retrofitting?
Interesting you should ask that, because they are they're getting into retrofitting right now. They had a huge amount of retrofitting to put in air conditioning, to put in all kinds of system, electrical systems, so that many of the fireplaces and many of these They use all of those for wires, for downspouts, for all kinds of stuff, and for ducts. And they've got stuff running in and out all over the place. And so there's a huge amount of retrofitting in that respect. Actually, one of the reasons that I got interested in doing this project was that in 1998, water was coming in underneath the dome and falling into the rotunda during rainstorms because the dome was getting sort of rusted and kind of beat up. And there was a big plan afoot to rehabilitate the dome and repair it. And but that was put on hold after 9/11, and they shifted to the visitor center for greater security going in. But it turns out that just this last year, they have begun rehabilitating the dome, and currently they're doing, I can even explain how this works. Here it is. Meigs devised this ingenious plan to build the dome because what he needed to do was the dome needed to be wider than the existing old roof. This here is the original foundation. What Meigs did was he put, at 60-degree intervals, he put brackets, This is a bracket that comes up, comes across here like this, and goes down here. And here's your columns going up. So this is cantilevered out. So what this meant was that you could put the cap on, put the dome on, and the dome would actually hang over the existing foundation, which is what he wanted to do. Well, he wanted to be able to make the dome appear larger, to appear larger by filling it in with this space. So, in any case, what they're doing, I think, and I'm actually hoping to write about it, is you have these cast iron brackets, and there's, like I said, there's one every 60 degrees, and they've been up there for 150 years, and some of them are pretty beat up. And what they're doing, I think, is that they're replacing them. That's what they're doing currently. They also have cracks in the dome and stuff that they have to repair. A lot of damage from paint, bird droppings, all kinds of stuff. And that they're having to do. But this is what they're starting with, to rebuild this foundation and the supports. Yeah.
I was curious, how many sections are there to the dome, cast iron sections, and what do they weigh?
I don't know the answer to that. There are many, many pieces to the dome, and the entire thing weighs something like 13 million tons. I'm sorry, 13 million pounds. Sorry. 13
million pounds. That's a very heavy end to a very great conversation about the Freedom's Cap, the building, the Capitol building in the run-up to the Civil War. And I'd like to thank you very much for the great speech, great insight. And I'd like to thank our audience here and online and on radio. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club of California in its 109th year of enlightened discussion.